I'm blessed by your blessing. I think I'll tell them all to be ready for a moving experience shortly. Stephen Dynan calls us to be evolutionaries. Teilhard de Chardin, I wish I could pronounce it like you, Anne, tells us that we're already hurtling down that path. I realized that meeting point of ideas last June when the idea for Dynan's book, Sacred America, Sacred World, popped into my mind during that conversation after the Trinity Forum. Teilhard's extraordinary vision has changed the worldview of those who have read and understood his books. And they, in turn, are describing and those people who have read and understood are now describing that compelling new paradigm with works of their own. Together, this body of research and writing tell a completely new story about our planet, that it's a living entity in a living cosmos and is part of the evolutionary pattern by which it and we live. In the mid-70s, when NASA's rover analyzed soil samples on Mars, it was using spectrometer testing to check the possibility of life in those sands. If the soil reflected back the radiation received with no change in the spectrum signature, it was dead. There was no life. Because, of course, any shift in the tiny gaseous atmosphere that might be signaling life would be picked up by a rover. On a whim, the NASA engineers swiveled rover's lens back to look at planet Earth in the distance and were stunned to see a ring of atmosphere charged with the very radiation signature they'd been looking for in the sands of Mars. The folks at JPL realized for the first time that this Earth may be a living entity in its own right. Well, that carried forth the work of Jim Lovelock, a British chemist who had been theorizing a whole body of potentials about this living system of Earth. He asserts that we are more than the third rock from the sun, situated precariously between freezing and burning up. His theory asserts that living organisms and their inorganic surroundings have evolved together as a single living system that shapes the chemistry and conditions of Earth's surface. This system self-regulates global temperatures, atmospheric content, ocean salinity, and lots of other factors automatically. A unique homeostasis keeps conditions on the planet precisely right for life to persist. Mother Earth is an evolving and learning organism herself. Her name is Gaia. In the mid-80s to the 90s, a second huge confirmation of the new story arrived with the reports from a couple of decades of neuroscience examining the human brain. Here's where what James Dynan would probably call Genesis Point 2, his version of the new story, would really take off. Because in utero, the fetus literally goes through all the stages of life on Earth in a kind of 7 days of creation or 9 months of creation version. It begins in uterine waters, just as the first life on Earth began in the warm seas of the Earth. It starts with the lightning strike of conception. The first structure to form is the heart, then the brain, and then a little spine, all within the first few days of conception. Eventually, the human fetus moves through its gills and flipper stage of marine life. And not long after that, it pops out the four limbs of its early mammalian heritage. From the Museum of Natural History, I found this picture of your great-great-grand mammals. But none of them grew the oversized skull at the top of the spine. the actual brain is composed of the real structures of the reptilian intelligence, the mammalian intelligence, and then the full human intelligence. And you can see them in this picture. There at the very bottom, those little turquoise arrowheads are the survival brain. That's the brain of the reptile that will fight or flight, that works by ritual, deviousness, and cunning. Anything to keep the system alive. Looking like a squashed blue donut in the middle is the social-emotional brain of the mammal that sees everything in terms of membership and relationship. And arching over the top is the vast new structure of Homo erectus, Homo sapien, Homo sapien sapien. And in the very front of that large mass is the very newest. Our foreheads are kind of like a little penthouse that popped out about 800,000 years ago, carrying this new neurocircuitry that is not often used, but has been identified as the stuff that I think Homo, what did Barbara call it? Universalis. Homo universalis is going to navigate with. Here is the neurocircuitry of empathy, altruism, compassion, telepathy, precognition, all modes of intelligence that reach past the boundary of the ego, that reach past the boundary of all the old social systems of the mammals, to envision and link in a whole new way. We're already wired with this. Carl Pribram, the eminent brain scientist from Stanford, asserts that our brain is a hologram of planet Earth, that it carries all the information and intelligence that has gone on in the entire planet, literally layered in living cells and function in our brain. This is who we really are. We are Gaia on two legs, inextricably interwoven with the life of the planet, designed to become conscious of our status of Homo universalis, waking up to the fact that our literal connection to everything that's happening on the planet, and now to the fact that we are all belong to the same stream of consciousness that's waking up on Earth. We literally are the evolutionaries in Stephen Dynan's book. And I'd like to pause for just a moment because this is enough information. Is it 10:20? Yeah, exactly 10:20. To cause a little tremor in our own understanding of ourselves. So to honor the fire department and the earthquake society, we're going to take just a moment of quiet. I'd like to give you a little instruction for absorbing the idea and then articulating it briefly to your neighbor. The first thing I'd like you to do is just in a moment to take a deep breath, close your eyes, and allow and see if you can sense what the first feelings are in response to, well, what Pribram says. Get the feeling first, and then sense, if you can, what the following insight or insights are that just naturally come with that. Your system is ready with its first response. I'd like you to catch it if you can. Just let it marinate for about a minute, and then I will ring a little chime, and I'm going to ask you to turn to a neighbor and just share briefly between the two of you what that first rush of feeling was and what those first insights feel like as they come from you. So, for the first chime, just a moment of silence to sense your own response to this. And now come back into the room. Turn to your left or right or forward or backward. See if you can find one. Each of you find your way into a twosome or a threesome. So I'll give you a moment to do that. And when you've settled yourselves, Will one of you say, I'll be one, and the other say, I'll be two? One and two. And if it's a threesome, three. All right, so number one, your first feeling of response and an insight that popped. Number one, feeling and insight. All right, and draw that to a close, come to a conclusion. All right, ready to change partners? Number two, where did this take you? And number three, if you haven't gotten a word in, now's your chance. And now drawing that to a close, last words, one more thing. I feel like the auctioneer. All done? All done now? All right. Thank you. Now, you're thinking like real evolutionaries. There are some important clues about human evolution and the way it works that are especially clear in the processes of pregnancy, birth, toddlerhood, and early childhood. We've talked galactically about the importance of atmosphere in sheltering the processes of life, but in the same way, the pregnant mother's emotional state generates the biochemical signals that trigger the brain development of her baby. The way she feels and responds during pregnancy supports either the frontal part of the brain, this part that is the brilliant thinking and creative part, or is signals to the hindbrain that consists of that survival brain and that first mammalian brain that needs all the cunning and deceit it's going to get for a tough life ahead. A happy mother becomes the environment for a child whose frontal brain is growing at a great rate. A stressed, chronically unhappy, in trouble mama is going to become the environment that will give her child extra strength in the hindbrain to face the life that's coming. The mom's emotional state continues to be the environment that builds the brain of the child once outside the womb. Evolution's rule for a good start is this: 9 months in the womb, 9 months in arms, and 27 months in arm's reach. Either mom's or that wonderful caretaker, the aunt, the grandmother, a nanny perhaps in some households, but the consistent loving presence. Remember, we're talking about atmospheres here, aren't we? We're talking about that soft stuff called emotions. Who knew that the energetic electromagnetic qualities of feeling and expression are on the same wavelength that builds the neurons and dendrites in the brain? That is what triggers the response in the child's brain to go either this way or that way. The job of the mother is to be the womb first, then the source of a continuous emotional and physical environment, a literal atmosphere, a literal energetic womb surrounding the explorations of very early childhood. The mother's state of consciousness governs the quality of intelligence emerging in the mind of the child. In the same manner, the family becomes the evolutionary matrix, a kind of energetic social-emotional womb that continues to build the child's brain and response system. Remember, it's being laid down in these electromagnetic resonating frequencies that cause brain growth. Now, the family is more than an accidental assemblage required by the needs of offspring. It's an evolutionary design that generates and shelters human development, the way nature generates and shelters the rest of the life forms on Earth. Families are ecosystems. Each life grows in response to the lives around it. And even the planet itself has its own ecosystem energetically. This is a computer graphic drawn on the basis of measurements of satellites of the EM fields surrounding our planet. Its shape is very similar to the shape around our hearts of our own local EM fields. In every case, these natural constellations of evolution, the family system, nature systems, the planetary system, possess an innate self-sufficiency, an abundant ecosystem in which need and response match up with each other in a flow of natural creation. Although we've been conditioned to see family groups and natural settings as sort of arbitrary arrangements, there seems to be a larger, intelligent design afoot here. The family is an evolutionary program. Next, let's turn to the headwaters of education as it springs up in human evolution. Learning, that Diamond later calls education, begins with the joyful explorations of the toddler who is driven by evolution to explore everything around her, to taste it and touch it and find out how it works. That learning engagement continues in childhood as kids move into a conscious state called play. We are all wired for play. And by that, I don't mean Little League. I don't mean the soccer club. I mean open, free play that builds highways of rich brain connections. And here, their greatest gift begins its lifelong development, imagination, which can turn a cardboard box into anything. Jung wrote, "Without this playing with fantasy, no creative work has ever yet come to birth. The debt we owe to the play of the imagination is incalculable." Maria Montessori and Jean Piaget both conclude that play is the work of childhood. And play is also the gateway to reason. In play, children engage in problem solving. They test out ideas. They ask questions. They build new understandings. It sounds like the beginning of any really good curriculum to me. But play in this sense, which is an actual state, a conscious state, is the essential factor in education that has been forgotten. So let's turn now to chapters 13 and 14. Chapter 13 is all about building the family. The evolutionary pattern underlying the human family starts in our midbrain, whose primary intelligence, remember, is to see everything in relationship. And there it is, that golden donut right in the middle of our brains. We are wired to live in relationship, and being isolated and abandoned makes us a little crazy. Sorry for this slide. Turned out not to be the gem I thought it was going to be. This is the mammalian brain, the social-emotional brain. What we call love lives here. Emotions and attachments to other come from this brain. This is the site of all family and social ties. Responsibility, duty, and ethics probably also live here. Now, the mother's body gestating the fetus, the mother's arms sheltering the baby, the mother's or caretaker's at arm's reach for the toddler, the family sheltering the children, the family sheltering each generation. It's like a little stack of Russian dolls or nested worlds, each a nurturing nest for the next higher stage of development, all resting surely and safely within each other as an evolutionary design. Until a century or so ago, when the stack began to come apart, we began to lose the stability of marriage. Today, our divorce rate is at 42%, which is a slight decline. 40% of kids are born out of wedlock in the U.S. today. But teenage pregnancies are down. However, the modeling for healthy families, the messages that laud the discipline and sacrifice a family requires, are MIA in social media throughout America. It's as if the family has lost its evolutionary job to a culture that's blind to its value. Most of its functions have been outsourced, and they're paid now to outsiders to handle. Our consumer-oriented society has had a heavy hand in the end of the functional family, making it natural to expect school, coaches, agencies, sitters, and daycare to raise our kids. The family has largely lost its function as the primary safe, creative arena to raise children, sustain health, with resources enough to care for the vulnerable and to ensure economic stability for the whole system. Now, neighborhoods have also lost much of their evolutionary function. They're disconnected from each other. They're isolated from the nearby community. Here's a recent mag from Tucson, where I have spent the last several weeks. It's all dedicated to rescuing its disintegrating neighborhoods. Now, Dynan offers a set of very direct solutions to rebuild marital and family relationships, and I'm sure you enjoyed reading these as much as I did. He would like to require training to get a marriage license, and passing a little practical test with some tune-up training afterwards. He would like, and these are good ideas, the inclusion of social and emotional learning as an expected family basic. In one of his footnotes, he recommends that you look into online the Toolbox training program for kids. Parents or grandparents, it's a brilliant program, and it's one that we should all be looking at. He would hope that another family basic is one that addresses directly and to stop and redirect bullying behavior. Well, it's such an enormous issue in the human family that I think that certainly education could be one piece of the answer. He looks for a new cultural emphasis through the media on healthy families, on healthy marriages, that might actually lead to a kind of structural strengthening of the habits of family life. I think of it as being similar to the phenomenon of physical trainings. I mean, we all go to yoga, Pilates, the neighborhood gym. Some of us have our own trainer. How about bringing the family dynamic in for that? And having a trainer, having a little gym of meetings, some regular exercising that everybody does. Food for thought, yes? Now, one area of family rebounding that does not make the evening news has been slowly developing over the last 30 years. First in Black and Latino communities, and now in white communities, the reconnection of people into stable, extended family systems that don't look like the cookie-cutter nuclear families we're used to thinking about. The original drivers of these rearranged families were marital and economic failures, or drugs and crime, and they were often only temporary. But the long-term study of this phenomenon reveals that it has become a cultural preference. they discover that they are like a unique social ecosystem with individual abilities and strengths, adding what's needed to an extended arrangement. The presence of these stable extended families has become a strong indicator of increased community interactions in the neighborhoods where they live. The social greening up of neighborhoods is still another marker of an evolutionary rebound when neighbors come together as an intentional community to support the inhabitants there. One story I found in Stephen Dynan's notes illustrates the principle. Two overworked young moms were conversing about being overwhelmed by their work, meals, lessons, school, and especially the needs of their kids, although one of the moms noted that her son had begun to turn around. Why? Well, he peeked into the metal shop of Mr. Thompson next door. He got invited in, and something clicked. The son began to drop in every day and soon began bringing things home that he had made there. The women wondered if there might be someone in the neighborhood for another son who was heading into trouble. So they asked Mr. Thompson if he'd go with them to ask all the men in the neighborhood about their skills and interests. He agreed, and it took them 3 weeks to canvass every man in the neighborhood. They were amazed at what they discovered. They found men who knew juggling, barbecuing, bookkeeping, hunting, haircutting, bowling, investigating crimes, fixing cars, weightlifting, singing, dog training, mathematics, praying, and how to play the trumpet, drums, and sax. There was enough talent there for all the kids in the neighborhood to tap into. Three of the men joined the initial team to inventory the kids next and find out what they were interested in learning. The goal was to match kids and grown-ups together for a kind of informal apprenticeship. But one of the men went a step further. Why not ask the kids what they would like to contribute as well as get? Well, a lot of computer skills emerged, and in the end they had a list of 22 things the children were able and interested in offering to aid or intrigue adults on the block. The six neighbors named themselves the matchmakers and began to connect neighbors who shared the same interests but were of very different ages. The gardeners team shared growing tips, and it showed four families how to create gardens, including a flat rooftop. People who needed work created a website where neighbors who knew about available work would post job openings. They found someone to take photos for the site and slowly opened it up for all sorts of neighborhood uses, kind of neighborhood Craigslist. Poets held readings. A block band got started. Neighborhood legends and stories got written down, and then personal histories began to be recorded. 3 years later, one of the moms summed it up. Quote, "What we have done is broken all the lines of separation. We broke the lines between the men. We broke the lines between the women. Then between the men and the women. Then between the kids and the adults. And between all of us and our seniors. All the lines are broken. We're all connected. We're a real community now." And one that follows that evolutionary magic to greater connection, greater consciousness, and that curious abundance that meets the needs of a circle of evolving community. It's a community of consciousness and presence and competence. Dynan's sense of sacredness is well placed to describe such a community. Now, consciousness and intention seem to play a role in this kind of rebuilding of family and neighborhoods. It has the same role in realigning our troubled educational processes with our evolutionary continuum. Our last glimpse of evolution's pattern for natural childhood was the state of play as the generative ground of all learning. Constraining that real world of real processes within four walls a desk, a stack of paper facts, gives a very limited model for intelligence to learn from. Yet our children spend more hours in school and in homework than they do anywhere else in their world. The information revolution is changing the format of education under our eyes. The demands of standardized testing and core curriculum are pulling us hard in directions that many educators question. When we surround these issues with the territoriality and politics of institutional education and the bloat of its bureaucracy, we have a recipe for public school problems. And yet, even as we watch the quality of American education twitching before our eyes, there are new successful programs of learning emerging to point out new directions everywhere. Dynan's footnotes for Chapter 14 hold volumes of helpful information. What would it take for every student to be known, every student to be loved, and every student to be inspired? This is the question that drove the design of Baltimore's City Neighbors High School. Inspired by the Reggio Emilia approach, learning at City Neighbors is deep, passion-driven, and active. Learners grapple with big questions through a myriad of long-term intensive projects. These projects not only foster learning aligned with state standards, but also inspire learners to be creators, explorers, problem solvers, and risk takers. A lot like that slide that we saw of children playing reasonably as a gateway to learning. Personalizing their interests, the projects provide the time and space for learners to delve deeply into topics that compel and intrigue them. And with City Neighbors' art-infused model, these demonstrations of learning develop as a vital art in itself. Family is a word often heard at City Neighbors. It doesn't just mean parents and children. It characterizes the relationship of the entire school community. Their governance model brings all the players, learners, parents, educators, and business, to the table as a unified board of directors. Perhaps the best expression of City Neighbors' socially embedded family ethos is the pod. What's a pod? It's 16 learners, one educator, and 4 years together. Kind of like Waldorf School. Kids gather every day for a two-hour block of time in spaces designed like living rooms with couches, coffee tables, and school desks. Each day, pod cohorts gather to discuss whatever's on their minds. When problems surface, they are supported to work them out collaboratively and constructively. They are learning how to live as competently as they are academically. Now, from urban Baltimore to rural California, here we are in the Lindsay School District in the San Joaquin Valley. Under the district's strategic design, their educational system has been turned on its head. Learners no longer advance through the system because of age or grade level. Rather, they are met at their developmental level and progress through required learning based on performance. Lindsay's teachers work to match learning opportunities to the learners' interests and needs, their learning styles, and they challenge them with real-world learning experiences. Their investment in technology will soon make all the school's content available online, so 24/7 learning becomes possible. They say that we no longer use the traditional grading practices. They've been replaced with honest and objective feedback that show where a learner is on the continuum of learning. Throughout this process, they say, we experienced many successes, but we made some real mistakes. The biggest one was not engaging the learners in the original community work sessions. At the time, we didn't realize what they could bring to the conversation. With our learners included now in debates and decisions, we're finding better solutions to these complex issues. They've become a significant part of the planning process. Listening to these stories and watching simultaneously so many school sites in trouble. It's a little bit like those television ads, you know, the ones that extol some expensive medicine that is going to make your life so carefree and your eyes see bounding across the green lawn, chasing butterflies, playing golf, while your ears are tuned to this dire dirge of the most appalling things that can happen. It's a little like this, observing our culture today. The positive and the negative all happening at the same time. And yet, this is the culture we have generated, perhaps more by inattention and carelessness than by deliberate design. It is made out of the way we think. Our brains were wired to create. And we've thought about it usually as creation with our hands, or creation into something that is a painting, or a set of mathematical ratios, or some kind of social problem solving. We have completely missed one of the greatest functions of our intelligence. Our thinking creates a powerful reality made up of the information patterns of our individual thoughts. These information patterns arise from our collective habits of thought and activity that coalesce into the traditions of our society. These collective habits produce a broad field effect that we take for reality and that we call our culture. They're even graphed. Here's one graph of the United States showing the cultural effect. It's not political in this instance, although they are using red and blue, just to indicate where the greatest activity is in the U.S., where most of the thinking is happening. Now, we can't touch these information fields, but they operate steadily as fields of mental habits and potentials. They are universal patterns of information that come into physical manifestation when the human brain tunes into a field and downloads it into use. For instance, the field may be biology, but it's the biologist who taps into the field and uses the information. Yeah, it sounds like science fiction, but it's based on decades of research. All experience arises from the mind first. Oxford Dictionary defines mind as the seat of a person's thoughts, volitions, and feelings, a system of cognitive and emotional faculties that include the incorporeal spiritual faculties of the soul. The habits of assumption and understanding that our collective minds make become the reality array that we call our culture. Here are a couple of stories about how information fields and the human mind work together. How many here like Mozart? Ah, yes, all hands up. A prodigious musical genius. In his 35 years, he produced 626 pieces of music. He explained that he simply sat down at the piano, put his hands on the keys, and the music poured into them. Then he would stop and write out what had come to his hands. Mozart said, "The music is not in the notes, but in the silence between the notes." A wonderful example of field music and downloader, its human expression, Mozart. This is an artist's sketch of Rupert Sheldrake, a gentle British genius of a biologist whom I had the pleasure of having dinner with many years ago. He has developed the information field the most thoroughly of any of today's scientists. He calls them morphogenetic fields. Morpho meaning changing, right? Genetic meaning generating. Changing and generating. They're not static, although they do not have energy, but they are available, pulsing, ready for the tuning in of the other half of the instrument, the human mind, the human intention, the human interest, the human resonance. These are fields that can be developed and changed through interactions with human mind and behavior. If the mind uses the same pattern of understanding over and over, it stabilizes that pattern as a field, which may be slowly changed by thinking differently. Well, when Sheldrake wrote his first book about this, which is what? Clear back in, what was it, the 80s? The British prestigious science journal Nature wrote, "This is a book for burning." Times have changed over the decades since, but not without a great deal of outrage. This is when science is at its most evangelical. Today, about a decade or two ago, a foundation in Tarrytown got so intrigued with the practical applications of morphogenetic fields that they offered a $10,000 prize to someone who could come close to demonstrating it or showing that it was an outright failure. One of the most interesting candidates gives me a chance to tell you a story that I think will illuminate what Sheldrake is all about. It involved a pair of teachers who decided to take on the challenge. They made up nursery rhymes of nonsense syllables that meant nothing, but that had cadence and punch and rhyme, and they just rocked along the way real nursery rhymes do. They taught them to a select group of children on the schoolyard, and they timed how long it took for the children even to say the words, let alone get them in the right order, and finally deliver a rockin' version of this brand new, senseless nursery rhyme. And then they took the nursery rhymes to the school across town. Again, playground, stopwatches out, the process unfolds. The words are slowly learned, they're repeated back until finally competency and mastery have happened, and they're rocking around the playground and the other kids want to know what they're saying. In the next town is where they go next, and then out into the county, and finally a couple of schools on the other coast. At any rate, they have a large sample, and the result is what you might expect. In each subsequent outing, kids learn those crazy syllables a little faster. Their competence occurs a little faster. It's learned and held on to a little longer. They created mini field that moved across space and time. So space and time apparently are not characteristics of this field. This gets more and more interesting. It's beginning to sound a little like God, isn't it? Well, I actually don't know and have never found out if they won the Tarrytown Prize. I couldn't find anything online about it. But I believe that that is a good example of morphogenetic fields. It is as if we are indeed a collective mind, and we learn in an enormous canvas and save what we're learning together. It may be a function of evolution itself. At any rate, I think this may be one of the ways that evolution works. I think this is very much the way our cultural reality is created. It's not far from the assumptions that many of us hold about the actions of faith. But I hope that this scientific depiction of the phenomenon of field building or acts of faith might stabilize for us into a way of facing into the maelstrom of the next few weeks. I would like to run our own small assignment. The field that you build will probably be felt only in your own existence, but remember, it's always resonating, and it may have other effects. I'm hoping that we can deliberately hold a stable, energized, felt set of positive thoughts, honest thoughts. You can't make this stuff up. It doesn't resonate. It has no grit to it, has no power. But honest thoughts that are positive, that we can bring again and again to the moment in these next months when we remember to, most of the time, we're sleeping away. But when we wake up and remember to do it, let give that thought form air and emotion and feeling. Perhaps we can bless somehow our endeavor as a well-meaning nation that has drifted off its healthy arc of development. Wherever we look, at the cosmos, at life on Earth, or into our own consciousness, the new story of which Dynan and Teilhard are both authors greets us with its two central visions of evolution and interconnection. When we look a little closer at human evolution, we find that the pattern for thriving human community lies rooted in the family as an evolutionary ecosystem. Searching for the conveyor belt of human development, we find intelligence as its engine, a lively, interactive drive to know and do that starts with the toddler's joyous explorations. Learning starts there, and subsequent schooling needs to ride that continuum to unfold the extraordinary capacities in our heads. Family and learning are the core carriers of evolution's dynamic patterns of development. From these basic understandings come all our more familiar visions, such as the nurturing of life on Earth, the central role of love as the basis for all social relationships, the state of play as the foundation of learning and creativity at every age, and the recovery of energetic, capable families and neighborhoods. Finally, the discovery of morphic fields that hold the vast templates of human knowledge and understanding into which our human minds can tune in show us that reality itself is composed of collective information, a kind of habit set created by the human enterprise. The way we think shapes the reality we experience. Besides voting, there is something else we can do if we really are the evolutionaries that author Dynan is calling us to be. Thank you.